by transcription.
Listen, America. These are the actual words of a mother who lives in the slums of one of our major cities.
Last week, my little baby, 6 months old, were bit by a rat. I woke up in the nighttime, she was crying. I put salve on her sore. That wasn't the first time a child of mine was bit by a rat. About 6 years ago, I had another child bitten by a rat. Let's see, which one was it? Amos.
Brucey Fleming is only one recorded voice among many that will tell you the story of how this courageous city has broken with the past and is now moving forward on three fronts toward the solution of its housing problem.
Living 1951, in cooperation with the 20th Century Fund, presents The People Act. True stories of how your fellow Americans are uniting now in democratic ways to solve some of their everyday problems. These programs are assembled and produced by NBC's special program unit, Living 1951. We call this one Crusade in Baltimore. Our narrator, Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. Let our field reporter, Elmore McKee, tell you why he paused in his nationwide search for democracy in action in the city of Baltimore.
Because, America, Baltimore gives the lie to a prevailing theory that community awakening, though possible in a small town, is impossible in a great city. Today we shall see what an aroused citizenry and a responsive city government can accomplish as they tackle a problem together. That you may hear the story as we recorded it in the voices of the people, I return you to Ben Grauer.
Once upon a time, back in Baltimore in the late 30s, few knew much or cared much about the slums. There was no public housing program. No house unfit for human habitation had ever been condemned as human habitation. There was no city housing program, no receptive citizens group to listen to voices like these.
I have a hard time keeping the house warm in the winter. Well, the door is half torn down, and you can see all on the outside of it. And I don't know how soon next, because it rains right in the bed.
Well, I have had my toilet stopped up for an year, and the zinc stopped up also. And the way we have to pour water out is out this back door.
It's been in quite many a year that there was ever anything done on this property. The condition of the property, you have water in the cell. Every time it rains, you're ankle deep in the water down the cellar. There's a lot of cracks in here that we can't keep no heat in.
And if these unfortunates, whose real voices you've just heard, found any relief at all, there was only one clumsy method, as city health official Dr. William H. Schultz told us.
In those days, there were no specific ordinances dealing with insanitary housing in Baltimore City. As a result, we had to resort to the use of the general nuisance ordinance for having such conditions corrected.
Then into this municipal jungle, dirty, crowded, forsaken, came a girl graduate, Frances Morton. Young, attractive, forceful Frances Morton, late of Smith College.
I was asked by the Council of Social Agencies to make a survey of the area to find out what the social agencies were doing. I couldn't be satisfied with just studying what the social agencies were doing. I had to find out what was wrong with the area and then find out what was being done about the situation.
Up one alley and down the next, day after day, week after week, month after month, walked Frances Morton.
I spent a year wandering around the neighborhood, and I saw things that I had never seen in my life before.
Alleys within alleys. Rooms meant for four people crowded with 11. Houses without water, without toilet facilities. Garbage-strewn yards, rat-infested fire traps. All this Frances Morton saw and, horrified, poured into her survey. Turn now to the newsroom of the Baltimore Evening Sun, where Clark Hobbs, today vice president of Goucher College, then served as associate editor.
Miss Morton's survey came to my attention and aroused my interest, prompted me to survey some of the areas of the city myself.
Slumming, but not for the fun of it, went Editor Hobbs.
And a photographer and I would visit the slum areas and collect data and illustrations of what it was that we were talking about. These were used in a series of editorial articles on the editorial page of the Evening Sun.
Gems of Baltimore architecture. Early American interior. With such ironic phrases, Hobbs captioned his hard-hitting articles to jolt complacent Baltimore. So that when Frances Morton organized the Citizens Housing Association, there were citizens aroused enough to join her. Citizens working together for the first time. Before long, they reaped the first fruit of their efforts.
In March 1941, we got this new city ordinance on the hygiene of housing with teeth in it.
Speaking, Health Commissioner Huntington Williams.
For the first time in history, this made it possible for us to condemn a house that was unfit for human habitation, either because of structural defect or because of sanitation beyond repair.
Now, at long last, Baltimore could establish minimum standards for healthful housing. To help enforce those standards, the health department appointed young, aggressive Yates Cook. Yates Cook, with only a desk and a chair, who told us...
Day after day, sitting at my desk, I heard complaints like this.
Complaints that we recorded for you.
When I asked the landlord about repairs, he says you're getting cheap rent, so he won't do nothing for us.
Daisy Laban complained that it wasn't only herself. Her neighbors, too, could tell of the same treatment.
My neighbor isn't any better off than we are. Her property is really awful. She had fell down at the steps and broke her arm. It's been lower last year sometime. And her landlord won't do nothing for her either.
Yates Cook listens, too, to people long afraid to complain, even when threatened by fire from faulty wiring.
The chandelier was down over the bed, and the bedspread, Chanel's bedspread, was all less like lights, you know, burning. One of the businessmen in the neighborhood told me to make a report of it, said that my life was in danger. I told him I was afraid, see, because I wouldn't have no place to go.
And if the tenants lived in fear of speaking up, many of the landlords did nothing because they simply didn't know. For, as one of them, Philip Needle, told us,
in those days, in my opinion, I felt that my tenants, as well as myself, were quite satisfied with conditions in slum areas. I myself felt that there was no need to improve those properties. It was purely a business proposition.
And so Baltimore began seeking to educate landlord and tenant alike, and public too. But even with its new law, action could be taken only upon complaint. But 2 years later, the Division of Housing was set up in the Health Department and backed by a new group, the Housing Law Enforcement Committee. Then city officials concerned with all phases of the slum problem in Baltimore really went to work. As Yates Cook, advanced to head that division, put it...
Now we could go ahead on our slum problem. We didn't have to wait for complaints any longer. We could go ahead on our own initiative, on a block-to-block basis.
And that's just what they did. Into 63 houses on one of the worst blocks in the city went Baltimore's now famous Block 1,
health, fire, and building inspectors. Pooling their authority in a mass attack, they compiled joint lists of illegalities, ordered walls straightened, roofs patched, windows cut, outhouses replaced with bathhouses, basements water and rat-proofed. Down to Block 1 with its new look, we recently took our recording machine, America, and talked to people like Esther Dennard, Willie Shippey, and Elsie Connor, who lived there before and after. Their answers are typical of what all told us.
Since this block has been improved, things are lots better. And I really like it, and I feel happy and feel much better than it was before.
It was no sufficient fitting place to live.
The landlord had the rain spouts fixed, the roof fixed, and the flow. Much happier than I used to be.
What particularly pleased Elsie Connor was what was done to the filthy, vacant lot next door.
Since the school property took it over, and now it's called the Friendship Garden. They cleaned it off and planted flowers on it. And I am the overseer of it. We have different kind of pretty flowers to make it smell sweet and nice and fresh in the mornings for the people.
Block 1, as you can well imagine, was a big success. But it took a year and a half for Baltimore to work the miracle there. One reason, housing cases were shunted from court to court, often heard by a dozen different magistrates. Magistrates more concerned with crimes of violence before them than with the case of the faulty downspout, as Mildred Atkinson, a volunteer field worker in the slums, recalls it.
In the courts at that time, a case would come before the magistrate and would be postponed, say postponed for 30 days so that the man could take care of the housing problem. But when the case came up again, a new magistrate would be there, and he would postpone it sometimes perhaps for 60 days so that it has gone on as long as 14 months in one court.
To see if something couldn't be done about this bottleneck, public-spirited Hans Frohlicher, schoolmaster and president of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association, tells us...
Finally, our planning committee asked into one room for lunch all the city officials who had anything to do with law enforcement and said to these men, "What are you going to do? What can be done? Something must be done about our court problem."
Suggestion after suggestion is made, but let Frohlicher continue.
Finally, when we seemed to be at the lowest ebb of the meeting, Bill Brooks, who was zoning enforcement officer for the city of Baltimore, chipped in his suggestion. He said,
"Look, why wouldn't it be possible to bring all of these cases into one court? Why wouldn't it be possible to establish a single court where we could have a single magistrate instead of running to all of the other districts? What do you people think?"
What do they think? They pounce on the idea. Petition the governor for and secure a housing court for Baltimore. Here now, the case of young Raymond Goodman.
My name is Raymond Goodman. The rat jumped up on a bed and bit me when I was sleeping. The rat bit me on the head. My mom took me to a hospital.
Hear how the case of Raymond Goodman, bitten by a rat as he slept in his home in the slums, was actually handled by Baltimore's housing court. The voices you hear are the actual voices of Judge Harry S. Krueger, magistrate of the court, and the others concerned. Listen to the testimony of William Sallow, chief of the Division of Rodent Control.
Your Honor, on October the 3rd, the Division of Rodent Control received a report by telephone of a rat bite of a child who lived on George Street. The phone call was made by the mother.
He testifies that a younger child in the same family previously had been bitten under similar circumstances.
At about 3:30 that morning, further investigation revealed that there was quite a large hole in the rear foundation of the building through which the rats had gained access.
He further testified that notice had been sent to the landlord before.
Nothing has been done to repair these deficiencies, and inasmuch as the notice has expired, we had to bring him into court, sir.
The judge listens to the accused landlord, finally renders his decision. You're hearing the very words he used.
This is a very serious case. Actually, a person was bitten by a rat in Baltimore City. This in the year 1950.
He reviews the landlord's excuses, namely that his contractor was at fault.
Now you tell me that the reason that you failed to do it was not your fault. But that is not a good excuse, in my opinion. Because if you hold yourself out as an owner of property, renting it to people who must live there, then you must see to it that the property is in good, livable condition. And it's certainly unfair to expect people to live in a house which is overrun by rats.
Then, in no uncertain terms, Judge Kruger declares,
I find you guilty.
Baltimore's unique housing court deals not only with wayward landlords, but with lax tenants as well. Is represented in the slum area by a detail of police sanitary inspectors who not only scour it for housing infractions, but also conduct contests and give prizes for the cleanest yards. But what about the landlords? What's their attitude? Listen to landlord Philip Needle now.
I have found out that it pays off in dollars and cents and a clear conscience to give these people decent houses. One day, a tenant of mine told me that her 13-year-old boy had gone to play in Druid Hill Park the other day and had come home hot and sweaty and taken a bath in a tub in her home for the first time. Imagine his first bath in 13 years.
The children. As in all these stories, we come at length to the children and what the changes mean to them, whether at play in Druid Hill Park or in the new comforts in their homes or in their training for community cleanliness in the classroom. For hand in hand with this new outlook, supported by law enforcement, has gone Baltimore's work with children in the schools. In her school, located in the slums, Principal Elizabeth Henderson had this to say about the philosophy behind their program.
That they will at least have an attitude towards a good community and carry that with them into adult life. I think that's our hope.
And so it is that in Mrs. Henderson's school, they've composed their own to the death against the old witch, dirt and disease. Listen to them sing. Do you remember last year, the year of 49, the cleaners chased the old witch a long way from town, a long way from town. The last thing we hear of her, the old witch was dead. Not long ago, America, all the leading groups concerned with Baltimore's housing problem came together. Representatives of public housing, without whom the fight on blight could not proceed. Representatives of redevelopment through private enterprise. City officials and the public joined to form the Mayor's Citizens Advisory Council on the Baltimore Plan, the name by which Baltimore's effort is now famous throughout the nation. For the reason they come together, listen to Chairman James Rouse.
Now we want to move forward. We want to see what can be done if we lift our sights to an entire neighborhood instead of just a block.
Yes, lift the sights of the community in a three-pronged attack. Cleanup of existing dwellings, redevelopment of designated areas, and new public housing.
We have 2,100 blocks of blight in Baltimore. With these three programs integrated into an overall full-scale attack on slums, we can eliminate Baltimore's slums over a period of 5, 7, 10 years.
And so, virtually just yesterday, America, approximately a decade after Francis Morton walked the slums in horror and Editor Hobbs wrote his biting articles and Yates Cook sat at the first desk devoted to housing in the health department, the pilot program of this new all-out attack on the slums, of which Jim Rouse speaks, was launched in Baltimore by Mayor D'Alessandro. And fortunately for our story, our microphone was there.
Ladies and gentlemen, this should be a happy moment for all of us. We are gathered here tonight to launch a large-scale war on Baltimore slums. Within the next 6 months, we're going to try to put into decent livable conditions every dwelling in the 27 blocks bounded by Caroline, Chester, Chase, and Preston streets. More than 1,000 families will be affected directly. It will bring to the community the experience and resources of all city departments and officials. It will bring to the community the cooperation and assistance of all social service agencies, as well as interested civic groups. And perhaps most of all, the most important of all, it will be a demonstration of democracy in action.
Which brings us up to date on Crusade in Baltimore. A crusade that, in the opinion of the Baltimore people who have closed ranks and are marching forward upon their problem together, has only begun. And now, back to field reporter Elmore McKee.
Yes, the Baltimore story has only begun. For the people have learned not only to investigate and to talk, but to act. And this habit of action is spreading to many issues besides housing. As we feel this pulse beat of democracy in Baltimore, it is not hard to imagine what could happen if this same force of citizen action were put to work in every community of the land. For as Hans Freulicher has said,
when the wave from other cities reaches the waves from our city, there is a resulting force of real consequence for democracy, for this problem, and for any other problem of a democracy.
Such is the great wave of democratic action that was started in Baltimore. And indeed, as Mr. Froelicher has said, it may reach out to other communities all over our nation. For some findings on these national implications of our story, let's turn to the Research Foundation, the 20th Century Fund, which is collaborating with NBC in producing these programs. And we're fortunate in having here a member of the 20th Century Fund's Housing Committee, Dr. Lillian M. Gilbreth. Mrs. Gilbreth has had a distinguished career as a management consultant and as head of the firm of Gilbreth Incorporated Management Engineers, which she and her late husband built up together. As a mother and public-spirited citizen, Mrs. Gilbreth has always taken a deep interest in community welfare. I'd like to ask you, Mrs. Gilbreth, if you think this Baltimore experience sets a good example that other communities might follow.
I think it sets the best possible kind of example, Mr. Grauer. Here is community action that is humane and purposeful and democratic, and it has a very special quality as well.
What is that special quality, Mrs. Gilbreth?
I mean its immediate, down-to-earth practicality. Walter Fontmore found itself with some very bad conditions in some of its slums. I'm sure that conditions almost equally bad can be found in a great many other American cities, both large and small. So often the reaction of the public is to demand a huge program of tearing down the old slums and building new houses to replace them, all well and good. But sometimes the program is so huge and so expensive that nothing whatever gets done.
Meanwhile, Baltimore doesn't wait for some grand dream to come true, but starts out on the basis of the here and now. Is that what you mean by its being practical, Mrs. Gilbert?
Exactly. The Baltimore Crusade shows what almost any community anywhere can do with the resources it has right now, today. The foundation of the Baltimore Plan is simply law enforcement. Almost every community has laws to set housing standards, regulate fire hazards, safeguard public health and sanitation. And if it hasn't such laws now, it can do what Baltimore did and pass some laws to cover the situation.
Then I suppose comes the question of how to get cooperation in enforcing those laws.
Right. And a fine thing about the Baltimore achievement is that all elements were enlisted in support of it. That is a true pattern of democracy, isn't it, Mr. Groff?
Yes, indeed.
Here we had citizen organizations, social agencies, departments of the city government, all working together. And remember, too, that tenants as well as landlords had to be educated to the value of keeping the premises clean, sanitary, and fireproof.
Yes, incidentally, one thing I noticed, Mrs. Gilbreth, was that very little progress was made so long as people dealt with just a single individual tenant or a single landlord.
Yes. A crusade like that just simply has to have cooperative effort. Our housing committee of the 20th Century Fund, as part of our general survey of American housing, studied this question of how to get better housing in run-down, substandard neighborhoods. Our committee recommended that owners of property in blighted areas should be encouraged to pool their interest, and that some help, such as reduced tax rates, might be given to private or semi-public corporations that were trying to improve the housing of a whole neighborhood or district in a planned and orderly fashion.
I notice you mentioned both private enterprise and public or semi-public bodies for housing.
Yes. Our housing committee recognized that under present conditions, private enterprise probably cannot meet all the housing needs of families in the very lowest income brackets. Some help from public sources usually is necessary. Improving conditions in slum neighborhoods is an immense job on which we have to use all our resources.
Mrs. Gilbreth, might our country's present rearmament program interfere with movements such as we've heard about today?
I should think that such a movement, far from interfering with our rearmament program, would be a great help to it. Obviously, as our armament program gets underway and as construction of new houses slows down, our need for housing will increase. The beauty of the Baltimore Plan is it doesn't use up great quantities of hard-to-get building materials or take away manpower from defense industries. It's based on fixing up and making more livable the housing that we have right now. This means a strengthening of our country's physical resources. And by this vivid demonstration of cooperative action and community spirit, it strengthens the all-important spiritual resources of our democratic, free world.
Thank you, Mrs. Lillian Gilbreth, for those comments and findings that help to illuminate our Baltimore story as a true example of American democracy in action.
Living 1951 in conjunction with the 20th Century Fund has presented another in our special series, The People Act. If you wish to receive a copy of today's script or to ask questions pertaining to the possible application of the Baltimore story to your own community, you're invited to write to the 20th Century Fund, 330 West 42nd Street, New York 18. We repeat that address, the 20th Century Fund, 330 West 42nd Street, New York 18. The fund will be glad to send you a script or put you in touch with an agency that may help you in your situation. Join us again next week when our field reporter will introduce us to some people who put democracy to work in a great industry in the city of New York. The People Act is produced for NBC and the 20th Century Fund by the Program Unit for Living 1951. Wade Arnold, producer and editor, George Boutsas, director, Lou Hazem, writer, Elmore McKee, field reporter, Ben Grauer, narrator, and William Schwartow, recording engineer. Stay tuned for the NBC Symphony conducted by Maestro Toscanini on NBC.